Good morning, everybody. It's great to have you here with us this morning. Very thankful that we could be here and be able to do these kinds of things. But we are looking forward to this all beginning to wind down. I remember I was just thinking as we were meeting back there, preparing to pray and pray for the service and all that kind of stuff, that I was looking at Stacy and remember our original conversation was like, this will be a month, maybe, you know, well, that's... And so, you know, everybody said they volunteered happily, and then little did they know they got conscripted for a much longer time, and so we're very thankful for everything that everybody does here. So, all right, well, we are still on the seven great I Am statements of Jesus Christ in the Gospel of John, and so far, for those of you who might be just joining us, we have covered I Am the Bread of Life, I Am the Light of the World, I Am the Gate, I am the Good Shepherd, I am the Resurrection and the Life, and I am the Way, the Truth, and the Life. And so we have spent, about 6 weeks or so, 5 or 6 weeks on I Am the Way, the Truth, and the Life. This is the fourth week on I Am the Truth. So we'll probably have one more week after this, at least, on I Am the Truth. I really consider it to be that poignant and that important to spend time on. So just going to John 14 verses 1 through 7, we see that Jesus is engaging in a conversation with his disciples. Again, this is after the triumphal entry, that he spent some time in Jerusalem. This is shortly before he will be arrested and beaten and interrogated and then sacrificed on a cross. And so shortly before that time, he is having this conversation with his disciples. And so in verse 1, we begin with, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going." But Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way?" Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." So he says again, or at least I want to just repeat again, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And so just very quickly going over some of the important statements I think that I've made about this particular text. I just want to reiterate, it is the core biblical principle and text, the hill upon which all Christendom and the Christian must be willing to live and even to die. Having said that, and I've said this several times, I want to say it again because I think it's this important, that there can be no more of a contentious cultural battle today than what it means for Jesus to be the truth, for Christians to imitate and to follow the truth. So when we talk about the truth, then the truth is the actual reality, existence in life. It is those things which are derived, that we are derived from and we act upon. So truth is reality. Truth is what is. And there cannot be anything other than that. And so when Jesus claims to be the truth, he claims to be the essence of what is, that all other things model themselves. All other things are predicated on him as truth. We've always had a historical understanding that truth is universal, that it is absolute, that it is eternal. That understanding no longer exists today in our culture. Austin, if you can go on to the next slide. That no longer exists today. In our culture today, Truth is no longer regarded as universal. It is no longer regarded to be absolute. It is no longer regarded to be eternal. We'll be talking about more about that, a lot more about that next week in relationship to the whole idea of truth within our culture. So one of the helpful passages that I used last week to see how Jesus is described as truth comes from John 1:14, and this is what the Apostle John has to say. When he sees Jesus, he writes these words: "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us." That word is logos, which means the reason, the essence of reason, has made his dwelling among us. "We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." And so I just want to say, as we talk about truth a little bit more and talk about it in a more personal way today, that it's important to understand that on almost every possible level in our existence, humanity struggles mightily with engaging truth. It struggles. We struggle with engaging truth. And so as an effort to try and deal with that idea, I came up with four principles for regarding truth in our life and in our world. If you can keep going, Austin, keep going to the next slide. Four principles for regarding truth in our life and world. And the first one is this, and I talked about this at length last week. Deception is a spiritual and physical, existential and foundational reality that must always be accounted for. And so there is a person at work in all of our lives who seeks to deceive us. So Satan and deceit is the opposite of truth, and he is in opposition to truth. So he is the opposite of truth, and he is in opposition to any truth. We read in Daniel 8:25, for example, which I read last week, "He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, when people feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand precisely because of his ability to deceive against the prince of princes. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power." And so we have to understand then, in terms of that first principle, that we cannot fully appreciate the importance of truth and how it works its way and through in our lives unless we understand that the second most powerful entity in all of reality is all about deceit and truth, and he's all about misinforming us and deceiving us so that he can work against the person and the work of God. And so every day that person and his minions are working to deceive us away from the truth of God. But here's the principle number two. Jesus wonderfully reveals himself to us as the truth to rescue, heal, and comfort from Satan and from ourselves. Jesus wonderfully reveals himself to us as the truth to rescue and heal and comfort us from Satan and ourselves. So look, without truth, we are blind and we are in bondage. Without truth, we are blind and we are in bondage. So by way of example, the greater the denial about truth, the more painful the truth is. You can go on to the next slide, please. The greater the denial, the more painful the truth. So we are deeply conditioned, all of us, I think, to default to certain ways in which we live in denial, which denial is not living in relationship to the truth. So, for example, let's say you have a physical illness. Let's say you have something as horrible as cancer, and you go to a doctor, you have these symptoms, you go to a doctor, and the doctor says to you, you know, you have this condition, you have this disease, you have cancer. And you say to the doctor, well, I don't believe you. And he says, well, you have it, and you need to come to terms with that reality. And you say, well, I don't believe it. I'm not going to live my life according to that. I'm going to live my life like I want to live my life, and I'm going to, because I don't believe that's true. And so you do. You ignore it. And you live your life according to what you believe to be true. The further along in that denial you go, the more painful the truth will be when you have to face that reality someday. And that's just true. Let's say, for example, you pull out of a parking area and onto a highway, and as you do, another person pulls out onto the highway, and they pull out in front of you. Clearly, there's nothing that you can do. You jam on the brakes, but you still hit them, and unfortunately, they die. It was their fault. But the passenger in the car and some other witnesses say that their idea of what happened was that they felt maybe you were going a bit too fast. Someone else says they thought maybe you were texting while you were driving and not paying attention. And so now, because of their perception of the truth, a large portion of your life is forfeit because of a truth that they have perpetuated, which was not the truth. So my point in using all of these examples is that truth matters, and that our lives can be profoundly impacted when we either ignore the truth or when somebody presents a truth of theirs that is not the truth in relationship to you. So many of us in our culture go about thinking that the only truth that matters is a truth that we have about ourselves and about the reality in which we find ourselves, that we live in. But at some point, there's a reality that we have to face. And the deeper into that denial that we go of what the truth is, in whatever way it manifests itself, the more painful the reality is when the truth really does manifest itself in our life. So a person can say, for example, I don't believe in the existence of God. I just don't believe it. And I certainly don't believe that there was this guy named Jesus who, when he made this claim that it was only through him that you could achieve salvation, I don't believe it. And the deeper you get into that denial, the further in life you go, the more horrifying it will be when you stand before God in the judgment seat. It'd be terrible because you realize that you had wasted all those opportunities throughout the course of your entire life to remedy the situation of your alienation with God. But you didn't do it. All the people who spoke to you, all the things that you saw, heard, or read, you ignored. You lived in your denial. And as a result of that, the utter horror of realizing, the painful horror of realizing that it could be different, but it is not. The greater the denial, the more painful the truth. So if we are deeply scripted to be a people or a person that is convenient, that lives our lives conveniently around the truth, that there are certain portions of our life that we live deeply in denial about certain truths in our lives. And I'm not just talking about the overarching, great, big, huge mega-truths. I'm talking about any kind of truth in our life. Truth matters. I've had students when I was a college professor who would come to me and they would say, I want to do youth ministry. And so as I would get to know them and they would do some of our introductory programs, it would become clear to me they did not have the acumen to be a college professor. It just wasn't there. I mean, a college professor, a youth minister. It just wasn't there. They didn't have the natural hardwired ability to do that. They did. They were hardwired for other things, but they were not hardwired for that. Nevertheless, some of them would spend $120,000, $150,000 to get that degree. And they would leave, and they would go someplace else. And because they didn't have the natural ability, they didn't have the acumen, the hard wiring to do what they say they wanted to do, they'd blow some places up, and they would blow themselves up. And then they would come back and talk to me about why they failed. They failed because they were determined to be something they really weren't. I could say, I want to be a doctor. Right? And yeah, it's Jimmy back here. I am a doctor, but not a medical doctor. But I could say that I want to be a doctor, a medical doctor. And I could pursue my dreams and be everything that I, you know, that if I worked hard enough and tried hard enough, but I am telling you, as sure as I'm standing here, I could never be a medical doctor. And not because I don't like people, and not because things are icky or awful physically or anything like that. That doesn't bother me. It's the hard sciences. I couldn't do the chemistry. I couldn't do the hardcore biology. I couldn't do the hardcore physics or things like that. I understand those things practically speaking, but I do not understand them as you drill down into them in a scholastic sort of way. That's not who I am. So I could go to school and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to be a doctor. And in the end, never be a doctor. And then face that harsh reality that I wasn't really being what God made me to be. So we have to learn how to come to terms with the denials that we live in. And here's one of the other reasons why the greater the denial, the more painful the truth. Is because the longer we live in our denial, the more we invest in that denial. And the more we invest in that denial, the greater the sense of loss when we realize that's really not what should be. We feel foolish. We feel like we've wasted so much. So I think that we need more of a culture that helps people to live less in the denial and more in being intellectually honest about what is true about themselves and about the world in which you live in. So with that in mind then, let's talk about the nature of a lie personally and so societally. So look, because that's denial is a lie. But I want to talk about a lie as it manifests itself, the nature, the body of a lie, as it's in ourselves, as well as it how lies are expressed within our society as a whole. Lies don't really become effective unless they are at least 51% true. And the greater the percentage of the truth in that lie, while still achieving its purpose, the more efficient and unassailable it really is. If you follow me on that. So really good lies have at least a 51% amount of truth to them, right? And the higher the percentage of the truth in that overall lie, the more convincing, the more unassailable that lie really becomes. This is a prevailing and toxic culture that we now call misinformation. And it absolutely holds almost every institution and most lives in hostage. So we get really good at misinformation about ourselves and about the world. And nowhere, nowhere is this more apparent than in the world of politics. I mean, the ability to parse verbs, nouns, the ability to angle sentences, to spin what really is, no one does that better than the political culture. The advertising culture does a great job of that kind of stuff as well. But they present a significant amount of truth, but that truth is angled and it's shaped and it becomes malleable in such a way that it reinforces an overarching lie. And so I think that it's important to understand that and to note that, because we are surrounded by it in every conceivable way. And it impacts our lives in profound ways. Here's another thought. Most coalesced power achieved is not through verbal threats or intimidation or actual bodily harm, but through misinformation. Most of the power that people get today used to be that when they were accruing power to themselves, they would use intimidation or the threat of physical violence or something, so people sort of got in line. But that's not how it works today. How it works today is through misinformation. I mean, there's a whole culture, so almost an entire science about how we bend truth to achieve power, to get to an overarching agenda. And Christians, I think, have to be very perceptive, because that culture is having a profound impact upon how we live our lives. And I'm going to talk more about that next week. So when it comes to testing the truth, then, I was reminded of Acts chapter 17, verse 11, where it says, "Now the Berean Jews were of more noble character than those in Thessalonica, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true." Now, this is a fascinating text. So Paul is, I think, on his second missionary journey here, and he encounters these Berean Jews who were of more noble character. So they were people who set high bars for their life, high standards. They weren't easily deceived. They were thoughtful people. And so they received the message, and this is from the Apostle Paul, one of the most learned men of his day. Clearly a person who knew what he was talking about, who had a reputation that preceded him. And yet the Bereans refused to just accept what it was that he was saying, because what he was saying was a radical departure from what most of them would have understood the Old Testament to be about. So when the Apostle Paul came and spoke to them, and no doubt referencing the Old Testament in significant ways, they refused just to accept what he was saying. They tested him. The Apostle Paul, the second most influential man in the history of Christendom, They just wouldn't take what he said for granted. So if the Berean Jews did this with the Apostle Paul, it should be appalling to us that most of us as Christians accept at face value what many people say today about any number of things, whether it's about our faith, whether it's about our culture, whether it's about ourselves, whether it's about our politics, whatever it is. We need to be like the Berean Jews. We need to be people of noble character. We need to be people who don't take things at face value. My old sociology professor, Dr. Russell Hedendorf, used to say, by the way, so I went to Geneva College from 1979 to 1984. I spent about, I don't know, $50,000, $60,000 on the education at the time for a private education, which was pretty significant. And Dr. Russell Hedendorf said this, and my sociology professor said, "There is always a reality beyond the one that you perceive." There's always a reality. And what he's saying is, there's always a truth beyond what you perceive to be true. And that statement alone was worth the $50,000 or $60,000 that I spent on my college education. Because it has been so informative to me. Because it seems to me that wisdom is always looking for that other reality beyond the one that you perceive. That other reality beyond the one that you have been told is true, that is the finality of what is really true about that particular thing. And I have found that to never be true, hardly. That there's always other realities beyond the one that you perceive. And you get a bigger, fuller picture that helps you to appreciate the larger reality, and it informs you in some very powerful ways. So, with that in mind then, there has never been a time in human history where there has been so much information and misinformation that could be accessed by so many people. So, and you think, well, that's a, you know, the kind of information that we have is a wonderful thing, and that is true. But what has happened with that is we oftentimes access information through an untrained eye. We draw conclusions having read from a narrow point of view on a particular thing, and then we think we know something. And so then we begin to speak and to live out of that. But then there's also that same avenue that gives us tremendous opportunities to know information is the exact same avenue where tremendous amount of opportunities are presented for misinformation. Because misinformation is the way in which most people acquire power, where they are able to advance their agendas. I've seen so much misinformation about who Jesus is, about the biblical text. I see so much misinformation. Look, if you were to only watch, say, sitcoms or evening pundits about the nature of the church, you would have to draw the conclusion, like, how has the church survived the way it has for 2,000 years? How did the church have such an enormous impact upon things like education and medicine? And not only social services and things like that. How could the church have actually shaped those things predominantly and yet be so false? And so shallow, because that's how it's presented. And so you know, based on the misinformation that's presented about the nature of the church, the nature of a Christian, we shouldn't be surprised if people draw some of the erroneous conclusions of how the average Christian really is or what the church is really like. It's all misinformation. It used to be, and you know, recently they invented some things to help us find out what was true in the middle of all that misinformation. So they came up with things like Snopes and Fact Checker and things like that, right? But I'm telling you today, I wouldn't use Snopes to check my basic math. I just can't trust them because I know that they have written on things that I know, many things I know not to be true. And it's all agenda driven, and much of it is misinformation. So when people cite them, when I have discussions or debates with people, I don't even consider it as a reliable source. I try as hard as I can in any discussion or debate that I have with a person about anything to go to original sources. I cannot depend on other agencies and organizations to provide for me the unvarnished truth about a particular thing, nor should you. I've said this before. If God is all-knowing, and we are to be like God, then we are obligated to know as much as we possibly can, to be self-informed, and to take the responsibility of being as wise and as informed about as much as we possibly can. So I'm just saying that things, even things in our culture that are supposed to be reliable in terms of, in other words, Snopes evolved because there was a lot of misinformation. So Snopes and fact checkers said, well, here, because of all this information, we're going to go out and get the real information and then we'll present it to you. But then they became agenda and ideologically driven. Now you can't trust them. Now we need a fact checkers for the fact checkers, which is crazy. It's just crazy in the world in which we live. So when it comes to truth then, and this is a more personal thing, there has never been a time where well-articulated feelings are mistaken for competent critical thinking skills. So if a person can articulate their feelings well, we assume that that is absolutely true. And to not assume that it's true means that we hate that person. There's nothing that's reliable about that kind of rationale at all. So part of the way in which we get to truth in our life, for our lives, is by developing critical thinking skills, which have been largely set by the wayside in terms of education and in higher education. It's all about the individual. It's all about their feelings and how they perceive truth to be. And so if they perceive truth to be that way, then it must be true. And we have to accord them that, rather than critical thinking skills, which really reveal what the actual truth is, what the real reality must be. So here are a couple of things I want to say to that. There has never been a time when Christians must bear the responsibility for gathering what needs to be known and confirming what they know in established communities of faith and trust. So I'm just going to tell you right now, the world in which you and I live, this is absolutely essential. Unless you want to be manipulated in ways that you don't want to be manipulated by, we had all better do this. That Christians must bear the responsibility for gathering what needs to be known. Whatever is important to you in your life, that you must bear the responsibility for gathering what needs to be known and confirming what they know in established communities of faith and trust. There are only certain theologians that I trust. There are only certain publishers that I trust when I do my study. There are only certain experts within the culture on any given number of things that I research and read about on a regular basis that I trust. So after I have done my research, after I have given thought to what I think is a really salient and important subject, then I have to measure that according to other communities, other institutions, other publications that I trust, other leaders or experts that I trust. Because nowadays, there are so many people who don't know anything but can speak very well, who can get on social media or on the news or write an article, and people think that's gospel. So if you want to preserve your heart and you want to preserve your mind, take responsibility for your thoughts, for what you know, for what you put into your heart, what you put into your mind. Because if you don't take responsibility, I'll guarantee you there are any number of people out there that would love to have control of that. There's an old saying when it comes to figures. Figures lie and liars figure. I can tell you as a person who holds a social science degree that I have been utterly, utterly appalled at the social science that people have applied in understanding this pandemic with the coronavirus. The lack of apples to apples comparisons is stunning. The causation correlation fallacies that are pro-offered is astounding to me. And so people just assume that when they watch this news program or read this article or whatever, that because that news program is there or that journal or that paper is there, that it must be respectable. That is not true. So we have to take responsibility for ourselves. So look, we've entered into, and I'm going to talk about this next week, we've entered into this world where there's this what we call a crisis of epistemology. And I know that's a philosophical term. I'll explain it to you in this way. Epistemology is the study of knowledge. How do you know what you know? And so it has everything to do from perception to what actual facts are. But how do you know that you know? And we live in this world where there's this crisis of epistemology. I mean, we've reached a point in our culture where we're very, very cynical about what we think is true, and so we just leave it up to ourselves. And so we don't know who we can trust. And at some point, we all have to reach a point where we're going to trust a certain group, a certain person, and then live off of that. But we are in this time of the crisis of epistemology, and so it has been devastating, I think, to the academic work. It's been devastating to the church. So how do you know this is God's word? How do you know that what I'm saying is reliable to you? How do we know these things? It used to be that we were comfortable with taking by faith that this was God's word. It used to be that when a pastor spoke, that normally a pastor was one of the most well-educated persons in his congregation. That's not true so much anymore. And so those kinds of examples have really impacted our ability to know what is true and what is not true. So when we think about the idea of truth, then, consider this. It would be utter foolishness for Satan, for example, going back to principle number one about deception, it would be utter foolishness for Satan to not use the power associated with the unparalleled capacity of information. I mean, it would just be stupid for him not to take advantage of all of this information that's out there and how it can be convoluted in a way that it would be misinformation. So we shouldn't be surprised by any of that. We should know that that would be a primary device or tool that Satan would use, and that he would use people even as he uses that. So the very ability to deceive, for example, is predicated on information and misinformation. It shouldn't surprise us. The very ability to deceive is predicated on information and misinformation. If you go to the next slide, please. So, for example, I mean, all the way back. In other words, this principle is at work all the way back, isn't it? I mean, it goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. Because we read in Genesis chapter 1 where it says, "The serpent said to the woman," this is after God created man and woman in the garden, "The serpent said to the woman, 'Did God actually say you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" Did he really say that? So he begins to call into question the truth of what God said. Did God actually say that? Then Eve responds, "You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree, lest you die." This is what God said. And Satan responds, "You will not surely die." And so what he was implying was your physical death at that moment will not happen. But you will die spiritually. And so he omitted that. You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And that is true, and that is not true. This whole thing is laced with truth and untruth. From the very beginning, you know, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, look, one of the reasons why we underscore the importance of truth itself is that it was because of untruth. It was because of misspoken truth. Back during the creation of humankind, that we are in the situation that we are in. It was the watershed moment in all of humanity. What was true and what was untrue in terms of what God really said. And that is true of us today. We live our lives according to what we believe to be what God said is true and untrue. And for many of us, those are watershed moments. As I was preparing for this, it reminded me of the armor of God in Ephesians 6, verses 10 through 20. So think about this. And if you have your Bibles, turn to that, Ephesians chapter 6, beginning with verse 10, where it says, finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. So be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil, the deception, how God arranges information, how he takes what we know and he uses it against us, that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. So the whole context here is it's described in such a way that this is always happening. There's no vacation or no day off here. That if you want to be strong, you got to put on the armor of God. And what is that armor of God for? The armor of God that Paul goes on to describe, that armor is for our ability to stand strong against the schemes, the deceptions, the lies of the enemy. In any way that he can contort reality, what is really real, what we think we understand and know, he's going to shape that in such a way that it becomes a scheme to destroy us. Verse 11, put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. Then he goes on to say, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. This sounds horrific. I mean, this sounds like we are at war with an entity or entities that we could not possibly hope to prevail against. And that in prevailing against them, what we have to come to terms with it, there are schemes at play. And that we need the full armor of God in order to withstand against these incredibly powerful forces. Verse 13. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. And having done all, to stand firm. What are we supposed to do? Stand therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth. And having put on the breastplate of righteousness. Now there isn't a piece of armor that we put on that is more secure than a belt. Wouldn't be your shoes, wouldn't be your helmet. It's the belt that goes around the middle of your body that is the most secure piece of the armor. So you need the belt of truth. You need the most secure thing that encircles the very middle of who you are. You need the belt of truth, coupled with the breastplate of righteousness. So there's no other armor that protects your vitals, the most important part of your body, your heart, for example. And so it's the breastplate of righteousness and the belt of truth that we need to protect ourselves against the schemes of the devil. But I just think it's fascinating that he begins with this idea of protecting ourselves against the schemes of the devil in verse 11. And then he goes to, in verse 14, the belt of truth and the breastplate of righteousness. Truth is important. Here's the thing. I never thought in my entire life that the words truth is important would be so crucial. I mean, you would just assume that, wouldn't you? You just would assume that the truth is important. But I'm telling you, we live in a culture where a truth is important, but the truth is not. And the a truth is malleable. It is plastic. It can be reshaped. The truth is absolute. It's universal. It's eternal. And it's by those things that our lives are measured. It's according to those things that we must live our lives. And that regardless of what the truth is, whether it's an overarching truth or whether it's a fundamental truth as it relates to our life, those truths are non-negotiable. And we must and we have to comport our lives to that. That's what integrity is. That's what wholeness is. That's what brings peace to our lives and healing. It's those things. And we as Christians have to raise once again. We have to privilege once again, as we have not done probably for decades, the importance of truth and how the truth must work itself out in our life and in our faith. So next week, I will try to talk a little bit more about Jesus as rescuer, as healer, and because what Satan doesn't want you to know, he doesn't want you to experience Jesus as rescuer. He does not want you to experience the truth of Jesus as healer in our lives. He does not want you to experience the truth of Jesus as comforter and peace. If he can take these personal components out of it, then he reduces the importance of truth to just a philosophical concept. And it's more than that. It is the very essence of our life.